Broadcast out of New York City, you're listening to Prescriptions for Health on the Progressive Radio Network on Monday, December 3rd, 2012. I'm Dr. Len Saputo.
I'm registered nurse Vicki Saputo. Thank you for joining us on our weekly Prescriptions for Health show on the Progressive Radio Network every Monday live from 10 to 11 a.m. Eastern Time and from 7 to 8 a.m. Pacific Time. And remember that our shows are available 24/7 on PRN.fm.
Today you will hear Vicki's 2020 health tips at 20 after the hour and 22 the hour. And we've got another great show for you today that will include: how will Obamacare affect doctors, patients, and the practice of medicine?
And who says there's no money in making vaccines?
And how about Tamiflu? Is it turning out to be a scam?
And who should fund medical research?
And here we go with the mammography industry again. I think they're clinging to a failed test when you're talking about mammograms under the age of 50.
And if you'd like to join in our conversation and have questions about our topics or your health, give us a call on Mondays from 7 to 8 a.m. Pacific Time or 10 to 11 a.m. Eastern Time on PRN.fm at 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888.
Yeah, we went to a good party last night, Vicki.
Well, this is the season. It's already started, hasn't it?
I know. And there, we kind of live in an upper middle class area, and one of the people that was there was a hospital administrator in the past at our local hospital. And it was really fun to talk to him, because what I found...
I thought he still was. He isn't anymore.
No,
huh?
He was for a few years. But he got into the essence of how you run a hospital. And I was very, very pleased to see that he was very concerned and was interested in hearing what I had to say about the challenges we're facing in healthcare today, which are substantial. And he agreed that one of the problems that we're seeing is that we have a system that's more geared to financial issues than it is service. And it was good to know that he had a side to him that cared about how service was. But to be honest with you, he really didn't understand how that could be changed, or how we could save him millions of dollars every year if he made just a few switches in how the hospital was run.
Didn't you tell me that he said that he was interested in buying your book, A Return to Healing?
Yeah, I said, I'll give you a copy. I said, it talks about the exact things that you need to know to find out what's challenging our healthcare system and why it doesn't work and why it can't be fixed. And he said, no, I'd rather buy the book. And I said, okay, fine, we'll keep our distance that way if you like. But, when you read the book, you'll get an idea of what's going on. And if you'd like, we can meet and talk about some of the things that we can do to support the hospital. Because, see, Vicki and I are not opposed to using Western medicine. That would be the silliest thing of all time.
Well, we believe in integrative medicine, blending it all.
Sure. And that it should be done in kind of a hierarchy that makes sense. So, for example, what we need to have is a system that starts out with lifestyle medicine. We're always talking about lifestyle, how important it is, and moving on to more aggressive approaches if lifestyle doesn't work. So one of the things we start with is diet, exercise, stress reduction, sleep, what you weigh, your meaningful purpose in life, toxic exposures, all those things. If that doesn't work, then we're interested in talking about getting a little more aggressive by using non-invasive strategies, things like acupuncture or chiropractic or Native American medicine.
Well, the thing is, too, is that you're so familiar and understand, know a lot about these other disciplines, and many doctors don't.
Well, that's true.
And when they don't understand, many times they have a tendency to just
throw it out.
Yeah, they
throw it out. That's been going on for centuries, actually.
I mean, just because you don't understand something doesn't mean that it can't work and that it's not an option.
Well, it's why our research needs to shift. The double-blinded placebo-controlled crossover study is archaic, and it doesn't serve us well because it leaves out something called an outcome study, where you try something and see how it works. And if it works well, you do it again. And if it doesn't work well, then you throw it out for the time being and maybe come back to it at a later time and test it again when you know more. So that was kind of a fun little experience we had last night, and I thought I'd share it with our listeners, because there may be some of you out there that think we're just really opposed to medicine, and we're not. You know, I'm board certified in internal medicine and have been for a long time, and I think I know it quite well. And what gives me strength, at least it should give me strength from the point of view of believability, is that I know Western medicine, and I can compare some of the other approaches that we can take that we can add to it to make the system even better. Because the idea is to have the best healthcare system we can, not just the best technology. I mean, technology is important, but technology is only one small aspect. I mean, generally speaking, if somebody's in an acute situation, take me to an emergency room, please. If I'm having a heart attack, don't take me to my acupuncturist, okay, or my chiropractor. Take me to the emergency room, or if I have a fracture, do that.
But many times there are other options, and so this is what is good for people to be aware of, is other options.
Sure. And we need to be in balance, and that's why the healing process is something I call the return to wholeness. Now, that's a big statement to make. What does it actually mean? When you talk about returning to wholeness, you're talking about becoming integrated physically, mentally, emotionally, spiritually, biochemically, bioenergetically, any way that you can look as a perspective. And when that's all humming along like it should, you're going to be healthy. You're going to be balanced. You're going to feel good. You're going to have a wellness buffer that's huge. And you're going to probably be happy and find joy in life. If any of those aspects go sour, then you need to look at the tools we have that can bring us back into that wholeness state, that state of perfection. We're operating at every level optimally. That's what wellness is about.
Remember that sign, plan ahead, and how the writing doesn't fit on the page? Yeah. Well, it seems that the same thing's happening with the Affordable Health Care Act. You know, with all the newly insured patients, there aren't enough primary care physicians, and this isn't a new discovery. We've been talking about it now for a long time, but how can 50 million new patients added to the healthcare system be well cared for with the same number of doctors and the same number of healthcare workers?
Well, you're right. It's not going to happen, and this is idealistic to think that somehow we're going to just shift systems and make it so that we can bring a whole lot more people into the system and still be able to handle them. I mean, where, like you said, where are we going to get the doctors who will take these patients? Because you're looking at doctors being challenged financially. And that's not a small thing that we can just ignore. Yes, doctors make a lot of money. End of story. That shouldn't even be part of the discussion. They make a lot of money, meaning the least most doctors are making are about $150,000 a year. You can live on that. That's that simple. You don't need a half a million or a million or 2 million or more dollars as some healthcare practitioners make. And so when you're talking about bringing in a system that doesn't reimburse doctors much, they're going to avoid taking those patients if they can help it, because they'd like to have a bigger return for the services they provide. And that means usually private insurance.
So where are the Medicaid patients going to go for care? I mean, they're going to end up in the emergency room and the urgent care center, but I mean, what do they do when they need to go see a doctor?
Well, that's going to be problematic. And the government, okay, is taking some steps to make it less unappealing for doctors to take on Medicaid patients. And one of the ways they're doing that is they're lowering the reimbursement rates for Medicare patients. That's if January 1st.
To make the others seem more appealing.
Yeah. So, and if you lower it by 25-30%, you're talking about a huge hit for the income for a lot of doctors that are taking Medicare patients. The other thing that's happening is that we're seeing doctors getting more engaged as employees rather than as private practitioners, meaning they will either work for the government or the county or some big HMO like Kaiser Permanente, which is probably the biggest and best of the systems in the U.S. And they're not going to be so much concerned with, am I seeing a Medicaid patient or am I seeing a private patient, because it doesn't matter to them.
Well,
they're on a salary.
They keep referring to safety net providers in the Affordable Care Act. What are safety net providers?
Well, that's the final last place you go to find a doctor who will take care of you. That could be something that you see in an emergency room. It could be an urgent care center. If you happen to have a really understanding doctor, it might be through an understanding doctor. It may be that we start doing things like email medicine, where patients actually will communicate with their doctors by email, and the doctors are around when they can, which is for us most of the time. I know our patients can call us 18 hours a day, or they can connect with us by email 18 hours a day, because we're up 18 hours a day or 16 hours a day most of the time. So a lot of changes are going to come into play that are going to make the system probably work, for, at least from the point of view of financial stability.
Well, with this Affordable Care Act, it seems that there's not much room here for other types of medicine besides conventional medicine and pharmaceutical drugs, you know? I mean, as far as doing anything that's alternative.
That's a huge point, Vicki, and you're right. As we go more towards structured care that comes from either the federal or state government or large corporate organizations, the HMOs of the world, you're going to see one-size-fits-all medicine be far more popular than it is today. And those people that want to do the kind of care that costs more money because it takes more time to deliver because of doctor time is not going to be allowed. It's like it is today. If you belong to an HMO and you are working with them for reimbursement, you just don't get paid if you put in more time than what they think is reasonable in general for that particular type of patient with that problem.
So there's not going to be much time to treat the causes of disease or encourage prevention.
No, that's right. And that's why the Affordable Care Act is not health care reform at all. What it is economic reform. It's insurance reform. And it's very stabilizing for the pharmaceutical industry and the insurance industry to know that the government is in their pocket. Because basically back in 2009, what happened is that the corporate part of America that's in the insurance industry and the pharmaceutical industry purchased Congress. That sounds like an unbelievable statement to make. But what happened was the following. It was about $500 million that we know of that went from the corporate hands in the hands of Congress. There are only about 525 or 30 Congress people, which means every one of them got close to $1 million if you average it out. Now, that's a lot of money to people who are in Congress who need money to be reelected and for whatever else they choose to do with that money. And in return for that small favor, they expect to be respected from the point of view of continuing their services the way they are, because they want status quo. The status quo gives them all the things that they're getting now, and it guarantees them that it's not going to be changed, so that they're out of pocket for some of the services that they want to provide.
Well, this certainly doesn't sound like it should even be a legal thing.
Well, it really isn't.
There's such a conflict bribery. Of interest that it's just
bribery. It's outright bribery.
And there should be like some big major court case over this.
There should be. There hasn't been. So when we look at Obamacare, it's something that will, yes, it will help the poor people more than anybody else. It's those people who can't afford insurance, people without jobs, people who have health care conditions where they don't qualify for insurance. There were definitely some things that were positive that came from Obamacare that were supposed to help us. So access of care is certainly one. And when you bring in that many more patients into the health care system, yes, it creates economic problems, but not for the poor people. It creates it for the people who are paying for it. That's the middle class mostly, and it should be, in my opinion, the wealthy mostly, because they can afford it.
Well, what it does is it pretty much just dilutes the care for everybody.
It does.
With this many more people coming into the system, we're talking 50 million more people.
Well, that's right.
And nothing else is changing.
That's
on
right.
The medical end, the same amount of doctors and healthcare.
Yes, but it does improve the bottom line for people who are poor. So
President Obama, when do we reach capacity?
Well, what's capacity? For people that don't have healthcare, it's getting some healthcare. For people that have healthcare, they don't care. It's not like we care about our brothers and sisters that are less fortunate than we are. The disparities in healthcare in this country are obnoxious. They're pathetic. They're unacceptable. We should have universal healthcare. We're the only major country in the world that doesn't have universal healthcare. And nobody seems to care. And it goes back to what I was saying in 2009 when corporate America said, we're not going to fund care for people who aren't going to pay their bills. And that means that they, basically the Republicans of this country, don't want to support the people who are poor. And they're calling them all kinds of names. They're lazy, they won't work, they eat too much. I mean, all these things they're saying are so inappropriate because they don't understand the situation of what's happening to these poor, disadvantaged people. You're born into a certain situation in parts of Oakland, California, or San Francisco, California, or Richmond, California. I'm sorry, you're going to have a disadvantage that's major. You're not going to have much health care, if you have it at all. You're going to be disadvantaged from the point of view of education, and you're going to be living in poverty that has a lot of violence associated with it. That's not right. And that's our responsibility as human beings to support these people. That's just the human thing to do.
Well, see, one of the things that's happened, though, I think, is that some people make it, give everybody a bad name.
Exactly.
Because they're lazy or they're trying to live off of the system and take advantage of it.
That's right.
And so then they give a bad name to the whole ball of wax.
Well, look what happened, though, Vicki. You look at the U.S. healthcare system, no question, technically, best on the planet. Nothing close. Number one for sure. Then look at what the World Health Organization did in ranking healthcare in all these countries in the world. We're ranked not number one, we're ranked number 37. What went wrong? It's simple. The disparities in healthcare are what cause us to have a ranking that low. And it's because of the way our culture operates. It doesn't care enough. It's saying that people are lazy and they don't work hard and they're interested in living off the fat of the wealthy. Well, you grew up in these places we talked about and then come and tell me about living off the wealth of anybody. It's not right. And yet there are some things about Obamacare that I like. First of all, insurance companies can no longer refuse to extend you coverage because you have a pre-existing health condition. That's important. And they can't charge you a higher premium because you're older or have a chronic disease. They can no longer have an annual or a lifetime limit. And they can't drop you if you have an expensive condition like breast cancer.
So those were big positive changes that happened.
Yes, they're big positive changes. And these are things that never should have been an issue to start with. But see, the insurance companies don't care about you or your health.
They want to make some money off of your health.
Well, they're not going to make money.
Or lack of it.
They're not going to make money doing the kinds of things that they're doing. So if that we're talking about. So this is where we are today in healthcare. And we need to make a shift in how we think. We basically need to evolve as a humanity so that we're doing things that are best for the people of this country. And we don't do that. So where do we go from here? It's sort of like you better appreciate the things Vicki and I have been talking about here because we're talking about you. The buck stops with you. It doesn't stop with your neighbor. It doesn't stop with rich people. It doesn't stop with people that are poor. It stops with each one of us. Until we make a shift where we're more interested in doing something to support our neighbors and do it in a loving way, we won't live in community. We'll live in some kind of society that has rules, and everybody's going to get away with what they can. That's not the way to go.
And it's so important for people to take responsibility for their health. And then you won't end up in a lot of these situations of being unhealthy and sitting in waiting rooms and so on and so forth. So living a healthy lifestyle, which is pretty much where we started out with, because prevention is key.
Well, that's what we need to teach. And so far, you know, nobody's that interested in teaching that. There's a lot of lip service given to it, but where the rubber meets the road, that's not what's happening. We need to make some kind of shift. All right, you're listening to Prescriptions for Health on PRN.FM. I'm Dr. Len Saputo here with Nurse Vicki. We're opening up the lines at 888-874-4888 if you want to join in on our conversation. So give us a call if you have a question about what we're discussing. And now it's time for Vicki's first 2020 tip on natural alternatives to medications for headaches. And when we come back, we're talking about who says there's no money in making vaccines. So stay with us.
aren't caused by an aspirin deficiency.
That's for sure.
So we need to find and get at the cause and then treat it as naturally as possible, which usually means eliminating the precipitating factors for the headache. So we need to rule out things like allergens, alcohol, stress, hormones, sleep disturbances, poor posture, or needing a chiropractic adjustment. Many times headaches are brought on by muscle tension, maybe a high altitude, a glare, a drug withdrawal, hypoglycemia with a low blood sugar. And then, of course, you can get a headache if you get a head injury.
You get blasted on the head, that might hurt.
That would hurt, or if you had a tumor or something.
Right.
But some of the useful natural alternatives, for example, would say you have a migraine. Often taking magnesium to prevent them at the beginning, like with the aura during the vasospasm, because low brain and tissue magnesium concentrations have been associated with migraines because magnesium maintains the tone of the blood vessels. And then there's an herb that's often recommended. It's called feverfew. And you might want to try some of this. It can decrease the frequency or the intensity of the attacks. And there's a lot of studies that show that it's effectively used even for fevers and arthritis besides migraines. And the way it works for treating and preventing migraines is that it inhibits the release of blood vessel dilating substances from the platelets, inhibiting the production of inflammatory substances and then reestablishing proper blood vessel tone. And I think it's good for people to be aware that there are other things, too, besides even the magnesium and the feverfew that are alternatives before resorting to taking pain medications and other things like that. So if your headaches don't respond to the magnesium or the feverfew, some of these other natural therapies that you might want to try before turning to the drugs would include things like chiropractic, which I mentioned, mm-hmm. acupuncture,
yeah.
Biofeedback and neurofeedback.
Mm-hmm.
There's a nerve stimulation device called the TENS unit. It stands for transcutaneous electrical nerve stimulation. And massage and other types of relaxation techniques, aromatherapy. There's DMSO that can be used topically for pain. And if you have a headache many times, if you put that on the back of your neck or at the lower part of your occiput, MSM, and then there's energy work that's often effective, like Reiki. There's guided imagery. Of course, there's a photon stimulator.
You piqued my interest there.
Which you use a lot in your office to help people with headaches.
I bet there wouldn't be one headache in 50 that we can't relieve almost fully in 5 minutes or less using that device, because so many of these headaches are caused by muscle contraction problems in the back of the neck, which refers pain to the front of the head and the temples. So it's a powerful tool that's way underutilized and very inexpensive to use. It's just shining an infrared light with the right frequencies.
And then other things that people can do, because of depending on what's causing the headache, would maybe be some meditation or diet, and maybe perhaps even balancing your hormones.
Good idea and great tip. Boy, that's pretty thorough. We tend to resort to analgesics, you know, take whatever you can take to prevent the headache from going on. And like you said, it's not a deficiency of analgesics that's our problem. It's just that we have underlying issues. And I would say most of the time, headaches are caused by people who have problems that are orthopedic or chiropractic in their neck. And if the alignment isn't right there, or if you have TMJ problems, you know, where that temporomandibular joint isn't right, very often that's a cause of headaches that's underlooked at, and a lot of the time we're calling everything migraine. And you know, migraine is not as common as everybody thinks, but if you have a severe headache and you're nauseated and light bothers you, people tend to call a severe headache like that a migraine.
If you have any questions about your health or you want to join in any of our conversation, the number here at Prescriptions for Health is 888-874-4888. We're being bombarded with propaganda to get vaccines. And many pediatricians won't even accept your child as a patient unless he or she gets a series of vaccines.
That's the most outrageous thing, and it's really true. Pediatricians are firing their patients. Can you imagine that? You hire a doctor, okay, because you go to see that doctor. Doctor, I'll pay you for your services. That makes him what? Or her what? Your employee. But nobody thinks of it that way. If I go to a doctor and I don't get what I want, I tell him, I kiss him goodbye or her goodbye. Because I'm not interested in putting up with somebody who's not going to listen to me or what I want. And believe me, that happened.
Yeah, with your
when
hip.
I had my hip done, had I listened to everybody, I'd be dead today. And that's not an exaggeration. Vicki can support
I can attest
that.
To that.
For sure. We went through hell with that thing, but here we are.
But on to the vaccines. The pharmaceutical companies claim that they don't make money off of them. And
yeah,
last
right.
year, the U.S. government gave over $5.7 billion to the vaccine manufacturers for children's vaccines alone. And out of that, well, $570 million was pure profit.
Yeah,
so
that's a little chunk of change.
Yeah, that was cleared after expenses. That was just pure profits. So I think it's time to review the conflicts of interest here again. I mean, people think they're doing the best for their children. And
oh, my gosh. You think that your child needs 60 or 70 vaccines by the time they're 18 years old? That's an enormous amount of material that's being injected into that person. And the data behind it is not built on good, solid science, I can tell you that.
And there are toxins in those vaccines. It's not just all stuff to...
There are DNA fragments. There are viral fragments. There are toxic chemicals in it.
There's mercury, aluminum.
I mean, they're not just something you go, oh,
antibiotics.
Well.
Antibiotics.
Yeah. I mean, if there was... I'm not opposed to vaccines. I'm opposed to bad medicine. And I think that vaccines, for the most part, are bad medicine. And it doesn't mean the vaccines don't work. But it means that we haven't done due diligence at doing the right science to prove that that's what we should do. And it's not like it's complicated science. It's easy to take.
Well, there are lots of assumptions that are made.
A ton of assumptions. And if the studies were impossible or difficult, that'd be one thing. I mean, all you got to do is take one community, give them the immunizations, and see what happens. And then take another community that they don't and see what happens there.
Yeah, but... They say that they don't want to risk that to not give it to that other community. But we have a lot of people that don't get them. So why
oh,
not
sure.
just clump those people together?
Well, there would be problems doing that, but that's a good thought. So,
well, anyway, there's a program called Vaccines for Children.
Yeah.
And they're claiming that this is a kindness thing. But actually, there's a lot of money that's involved in this.
Well, they give vaccines to kids for free if they can't afford it. And so they look like they're really doing something great. But what are they getting in return for it? Try immunity from any kind of recourse, either financial or legal, unless they do something that's outright illegal, which
so if the child is harmed from the vaccine or gets
you're out of luck
complications or whatever, there's nothing you can do.
Well, you can go to these people who are reviewing that from the government.
Well, how does the government profit from the vaccines when they give the money for them?
Well, the government doesn't, unless you assume that the health of the people will be better.
Well, so why is the government giving all this money?
Because there's a conflict of interest between those people and the government who are working with
they're owing favors.
Yeah.
Like we were talking about earlier.
It's the same old thing. It's a good old boys club. I'll help you. You help me.
And then there was there's all the kinds of conflicts of interest. I mean, we've talked about Julie Gebberding many times, how she was working for the CDC. And
she was in charge of the CDC, the chief. Of the CDC, okay?
And now she's in some bigwig in Merck Pharmaceuticals.
She's not just some bigwig. She's the president of their vaccine department and is making millions of dollars of profit if she's getting the same thing that people who work for other companies are getting. So what we're looking at is a revolving door between the CDC and the pharmaceutical industry, just as we do between the FDA. And the pharmaceutical industry.
Well, one of the things for people to be aware of in reality is that Big Pharma's first loyalty is to their shareholders. It's not really to the patients. And
That's
it doesn't
right.
really create cures. These pharmaceutical companies are creating customers.
You're right. Okay, it's time for our PRN.FM station break. You're listening to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Sabuda with Nurse Vicki. We'll be right back with more Prescriptions for Health Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. And when we come back, we'll be talking about, is Tamiflu a scam? So stay tuned for more Prescriptions for Health Radio. Welcome back to Prescription for Health. I'm Dr. Lynn Sabuda here with Nurse Vicki.
Is its approved drug, and it's recommended from the CDC and the World Health Organization and the FDA, along with the pharmaceutical companies, to be given with first symptoms of the flu. And they recommend that all countries stockpile it. Well, doesn't this sound good?
It sounds like there's an emergency, and you better get your Tamiflu pills if there's a problem.
But there's no data.
Well, there's no data that they'll release. So the problem is that the British Medical Journal has been after them, along with people from the Cochrane organization, which is a very well-respected
authentic authority. Yeah.
Yes, and basically, what happens is the person who's in charge of Tamiflu at Roche, Donald McLean, has said that they're just not going to release the information because they don't want to.
Well, how did the FDA pass it, and why did the World Health Organization and the CDC endorse it? I mean, why doesn't Roche reveal the data? Just do it.
Why doesn't the FDA reveal all that stuff? I mean, there's a lot of information here that's just being suppressed. And when it's suppressed like that, you don't know what's going on. So Tom Jefferson, who is probably the most respected person in immunizations in the world, is livid about what's happening there. In fact, he's livid about what's happening with most vaccines because he says the science is so bad, like we were talking about before, that here we are doing things that have been approved by the FDA and are supported by the World Health Organization and the CDC, and somebody's making a lot of money.
So what does it really do? I mean, it only shortens the flu by about a half a day to a day.
Well, that's right.
And there's dangers of side effects.
Well, and also there's no real solid data that shows that it prevents pneumonia or it reduces mortality. So what are we talking about here? I mean, maybe when I say the name Donald Rumsfeld, more of your ears will perk up because he doesn't exactly have a reputation for integrity. And he's involved with this and in a major way because he owns stock in Roche.
But this is just amazing to be able to get by without available data on the Tamiflu. I mean, it's very suspicious because if there was nothing wrong with it, it seems like they would be eager to get the data out of there. Out.
Yeah,
but
just,
they're getting by with it anyway because it's already been approved.
All right, so it's approved.
So why rush?
Well, that's right. So why would you want to take risk of the kinds of things that can go wrong? Like nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, hepatitis, anaphylaxis, hemorrhagic colitis, neuropsychological problems, hallucinations, and suicide. Why would you want to take that risk to save a half a day or a day of flu symptoms?
You know, yesterday I was hearing on the radio that there was somebody that was some sort of a football player, I guess, in Kansas,
mm-hmm.
and that he shot his wife in front of his mother and his baby. Then he left and went to his coaches to thank them for something to do with the football, and then he turned around and shot and killed himself. And then they were, what the show was about was how the game went on anyway. So they went ahead and they played the football game. But I thought, and then they were talking about whether they should honor him or not because he'd been a good football player. And I thought, you know, maybe this guy was on some medication. You know, suicide is a side effect of other medications too.
Oh,
even,
sure.
Even antidepressants.
For sure.
Maybe that's why he did something like that. Who knows? I don't know. I don't even know his name. I don't know his history or
there
anything.
Are a lot of other stories that came out of Japan where Tamiflu was something that was really popular. And there the rate of suicides went way up and a lot of suicidal ideation as well. So what we're looking at is how the American people can be hoodwinked so much. You know, I just was watching on television an ad for Tamiflu. And they're talking about how you should call your doctor and that if you have the flu, you should make sure you take it in the first 48 hours because it'll make you feel better. But they aren't presenting it the way we're presenting it. They're telling you the whole story of it. They aren't telling you that there's weak data that supports the premises that they're making. They don't really highlight the effect of the side effects that are there.
And do you want to trade a half a day of feeling better to get hemorrhagic colitis? That means hemorrhaging out of your poop?
Yeah, well, that's right. So this is not something that's small. I mean, these are major issues that if we don't pay more attention to and start thinking for ourselves, we're going to be at the mercy of the direct-to-consumer ads that we're all seeing on television and that our doctors are seeing as well.
Well, you know, Cochrane, this group that we were talking about, they're a not-for-profit international organization, and they're recognized for high-quality information about mm-hmm. the effectiveness of healthcare from evidence-based research, and they don't accept commercial or conflicted funding. Good for them. But they found discrepancy in the effects and the action of the Tamiflu.
Well, I should think so.
And again, if it's okay, why are they procrastinating? It looks like a cover-up, and it fits right in with the flu vaccine deception.
Well, that's another story in itself, and if you're interested in learning more about that, go to our website at drsaputo.com and put in the infection deception, and there you'll come across a well-referenced article that I wrote that's about 15 pages long that was published in the Townsend Letter that talked about the scam of the swine flu and how the World Health Organization, the FDA, the CDC, Julie Gerberding, and even the White House made all these threats about how dangerous this was going to be and that they needed to do something to stop it from being a global catastrophe. They even changed the rules for what a pandemic is. It used to be when a lot of people died from a serious illness. Now it just means that you can track a cold in different countries and they call it a pandemic. Something wrong with that picture.
It's so ridiculous. It's almost funny, but it's really not funny at all.
Okay. You're listening to Prescriptions for Health on PRN.FM. I'm Dr. Len Saputo with Nurse Vicki, and it's time for Nurse Vicki's final 2020 tip on how to take and store homeopathic remedies. And when we come back, we'll be talking about who should fund medical research. There's a big one. And once again, we'll be talking about the mammography industry and how it's clinging on what I call a failed test.
What's a safe way to treat colic, ear infections, teething, cuts, and more in children and adults? You know, we hear about and we see homeopathy all around us, even at some of the checkout stands. But do we really know what it is? It's different than taking herbs. Homeopathy is a remedy for a symptom, and it's in a micro dilution or a micro dose of the very same plant, mineral, or chemical substance that's in its original concentration that'll bring on that illness. So, for example, I'm just going to make something up. Say you have poison oak and you took a homeopathy, it might have a very, very minuscule amount of poison oak in it, but you're not enough that would give it to you. So it's supposed to take care of it.
Right.
And what I find fascinating is that the weaker the dilution, the stronger and the deeper acting the remedy. In fact, the most dilute remedies have no detectable original active ingredient left in them, and their effect seems to be created by the energy of the substance. I remember a homeopathist that I had several years ago, and he told me this story about how in the olden days when the doctors would go in a horse and buggy to go visit their patients and they had homeopathy, the patients that were the furthest away from where the doctor started were the ones that got better sooner. So it seemed to have to do with the movement of the solution in the wagon.
It's called succussion, Vicki, and that's what they do is they violently shake this, and somehow that impregnates the information into the water that carries these substances in a way that's different than biochemistry, because this is not a biochemical reaction we're seeing. This is a bioenergetic, a biophysical reaction that we're seeing.
Now, a classical homeopath will ask like an array of unusual questions, and in that way, truly treat the individual. So they might ask you, find out about your personality and what your tastes are and your emotions and that kind of thing. So that two individuals with the same diagnosis might be prescribed different remedies, and it's treating the individual with the disease rather than the disease alone. But it's interesting also that homeopathy can also be effective without the individualization. So if you're going to pick one yourself on your own, choose a formula that corresponds to your primary complaints. So the combination formulas will include the most common remedies indicated for the main complaint and the associated symptoms. So homeopathic remedies, I have some tips of things that you should be aware of if you're planning to use them.
Good.
You need to keep them out of direct sunlight.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't want to directly touch them. So you use the cap of the container. So say if it's a capsule or a little pellet or whatever it is, don't put it in your hand. Just put it in the capsule and then
put it in your mouth.
Don't eat or drink for 15 minutes before or after you use them. So in other words, your mouth needs to be clean with no tastes, odors, flavors, smoke, mint, gum, anything like that. A good time, I think, is first thing in the morning, and if you have to take it other times, keep those things in mind. Mm-hmm. Completely avoid camphor. Things like Vicks and Noxzema and Tiger Balm and Chapstick and shaving creams and liniments and makeup, anything like that that might have that odor in it. Avoid major dental work. So you don't want to be getting drilling and grinding and ultrasonic cleaning. So manual cleaning is okay, though. And you don't want to be taking drugs when you're taking homeopathic, but you need to consult your prescriber first. Mm-hmm. And I thought it was interesting about electric blankets. Turn them on before you get into bed and off when you get in. But that's a good idea anyway.
It's not good
to sleep with because of the electromagnetic fields.
That's right.
And if for some reason you need an antidote, Australian tea tree oil and Podarco tea are good for that. So with homeopathy, you can learn to treat minor problems before they require medical intervention. And it's a safe way to go, especially with babies and children. But when possible, it's always best to consult a homeopathist for treatment rather than to be doing it on your own. I know not long ago I had a fall. And I happened to have in my little pack with me when I was with my horse, I had some rescue remedy that I always carry with me. And I just put some of that under my tongue and I put arnica on the places that I hurt. Mm-hmm. But I remember years ago a horse I don't remember why. He was excited about his food or something anyway. He didn't mean to hurt me, but he pushed my head right into a post.
Oh, my gosh.
Really hard. And my son, Sean, was there, and he got really upset. But I was with my homeopathist, and he gave me some rescue remedy. And Sean said, that stuff really worked. He says, I can't believe it. He said, you should have just been, like, totally knocked out and everything else, and I was fine. So.
You know, before I read about homeopathy and learned how it works, what convinced me that there was something to it is the fact that some of my colleagues in medicine who are MDs were using homeopathy rather than drugs or technologies.
MDs, huh?
A lot of MDs use it, and it's licensed in a lot of states as a legal thing to do. In fact, many MDs are practicing under a homeopathy license in other states. In California, there is no licensing board for homeopathy, but the medical board has had the good sense to leave them alone. They haven't caused any problems, and they're doing some good. So that's a great tip.
Okay. So, you know, we depend on medical research to make important decisions about our health care.
I'll say.
And because of all the conflicts of interest, how do you think we should deal with it?
Well, the question is who should fund medical research, really? Because what you're looking at is people who are doing the research usually have an underlying motive for doing the research. So you look at who's funding research now. Well, the National Institutes of Health should be pretty straightforward. They're not, but they should be pretty straightforward in making sure that people are doing good research with the money that they're giving. And they spend $32 billion a year on research. But the pharmaceutical industry spends twice that amount, actually more than that. They're spending more like $60 billion. So the total comes to somewhere around $95 to $100 billion of research money that's being spent. And you can bet your sweet bottom that if Big Pharma is spending a few hundred million dollars on a study, that if it doesn't come out right, then they're going to take a big hit for it. And so their tendency is to do whatever they can to twist what that data shows and publish it.
You know, I think it's interesting how it's predicted by a couple of Johns Hopkins faculty members that government and drug company biomedical research funding is diminishing. So do you believe that?
Well, it may be on the downside, and I don't think it's all bad, because we don't need more research. What we need is good research.
But why do you think this is happening?
Well, some of it is because the government isn't going to spend quite as much money, and studies are costing upwards of a half a billion dollars to do now. And that's something to really consider.
So what impact will it have on Western medicine?
Well, it's going to get rid of some bad research, and it's going to get rid of some good research. I mean, and it's not just me and Vicky that are saying that the research that's out there is not quality research. You'd think that when somebody spends a lot of money on something, they've got good scientists working, that they would have great research. But you ask the editors, the chief editors of the New England Journal of Medicine, the Journal of the American Medical Association, and of one other journal that Ushma Neal is in charge of. And what you're going to find is they're going to tell you, and these are MDs or PhDs who were the chief editors of these journals in the past, are saying that the research that's coming across their desk that's getting published in these journals is not high quality stuff because of the conflicts of interest. So it's not about having more research that's like this. It's about finding a way to take away the conflicts of interest. And one of the suggestions that these people from Hopkins came up with is that private industry, you know, private individuals or organizations.
Well, what would be the incentive for the private sector as a source for
Well, if somebody has the illness themselves, or if some organization is about a certain illness and they want to sponsor research, I think that's good. But when you're talking about giving it to people who are going to profit from it, like private individuals who would be making...
Yeah, you're talking about mutual funds and things.
Well, yeah, I mean, that gets very complex.
Because then it gets to be similar to the pharmaceuticals' motivations.
Well, it might even be worse if you have individuals who are putting up money because they're making an investment rather than they're concerned about getting good information.
So they really want a positive outcome.
Well, yeah, the return on investment is what they're depending on. So we've got a huge issue here that is not being addressed. I mean, if we don't do something to get good information, how will you feel when you're in the hospital and you're sick and an article comes out and says, hey, this is a great treatment for the condition you have, and your doctor says, hey, I just came across this article, let's try this particular approach that might be a drug or a technology, and it turns out to be hogwash. Look what happened with Vioxx, you know, a drug that's like Celebrex and Advil. The drug companies knew what they were doing with that. In 1995, they came out with this drug knowing that it caused heart attacks and strokes. They didn't divulge it to the FDA, at least so they say. And then 5 years after it comes out in 1999, doctors are finding out that people are having too many heart attacks and strokes. Probably 50,000 people died from that. And it was taken off the market. Now, that's not just being dishonest. That's murder, because they knew what they were doing. That kind of attitude is not what we need in healthcare. We need to get as good information as we can so that when we're treating people with these approaches, that we're on solid ground and we're doing the right thing. You don't want to be poisoning your patients. You want to be supporting them.
Well, of course. Currently NIH spends $32 billion a year, and Big Pharma spends $60 million.
Billion.
Oh, a billion, That's I'm right. sorry, billion on research. What do you think would work for like something like Big Pharma to not do the research directly, but maybe pay the government the NIH to do the research, and then the Big Pharma... because Big Pharma needs the studies, but this way they wouldn't be interpreting themselves or having a conflict of interest.
Right. Well, I don't think that they should be allowed to do research themselves. It's not supervised by somebody responsible, that's honest, that doesn't have a conflict of interest.
Because we need independent government-sponsored research.
That's exactly right. And so the NIH could do that, but the NIH cannot take a penny from anybody, because then they have conflicts of interest themselves, as we found out from the FDA, who gets about 25% of their income from where?
Big Pharma.
So all of a sudden, the FDA is in the pocket, okay, of Big Pharma, and there's a conflict of interest there, because if they don't get that income, they lose it.
Well, right now, NIH is reducing their allotment for grants.
Well, I think that what we need is Congress to fund the National Institutes of Health. The money that comes in for doing research through NIH, if it was done by the pharmaceutical or paid for by the pharmaceutical industry, should go to Congress. It shouldn't go to, and I don't mean individual people, it should go to the government. And that is what will keep it from having conflicts of interest.
Okay, well, so how about mammograms? It's time to talk about mammograms again, because the mammogram rates have dropped since the new United States Preventive Services Task Force guidelines changed the screening age for women from 40 to 50 years of age. And the Radiological Society of North America is concerned because business is dropping, and they claim that 20% of breast cancers are being missed. Well, the way the article came out with researchers assessing the revised guidelines, it's pretty skewed to get people confused about it, and it seems like there's a turf war going on. Well, the American Cancer Society is holding out in favor of the yearly mammograms starting at age 40. And besides the mammograms, now additional screenings are being advised for women with dense breasts. So what do you think of the new contrast mammograms and MRIs for detecting breast cancer?
Well, see, Vicki, these are all approaches to fight for turf. And there's a business involved here that's huge. And people who are involved with mammograms in any way, either reducing the equipment or the radiologists who are reading it or the surgeons that are depending on it, even the pharmaceutical industry that probably is the worst of all, and you'd say, how could that be connected? But it's pretty straightforward. If we don't overdiagnose, like we are, certain kinds of cancer, they're not going to need to treat those people. That sounds stupid, doesn't it? You think, who would want to overtreat? Well, take the example of ductal carcinoma in situ of the breast.
Which makes a lot of money.
Well, it makes a ton of money for big pharma and for all the associated fields that are with it, because what happens is you've got an illness here that only about 3% of the time is going to kill you. The other 97% of the time, however, there's treatment that is being recommended by the oncologists and surgeons. So you're looking at chemotherapy, radiation, and surgery being done on 97% of people who have this cancer that makes up about 30% of all the cancers that we're diagnosing. And they didn't need it in the first place.
So what do you think about all these scans? Because dense breasts quadruple the risk of breast cancer, and now it's advised that women with dense breasts have supplemental screening tests.
Well, if you have fibrocystic disease, not just dense breasts, your risk for breast cancer goes up 4 to 6 times.
I mean, it's kind of hard, firm,
it's
and
lumpy.
Lumpy.
And the problem is you can't differentiate a cancer from another dense tissue, another fibrocystic area of the breast, because they have roughly the same tissue density. So
and
when you do an X-ray,
and they look the same on the mammogram, right?
Well, they're pretty close, and there, a lot of errors are made in under and over diagnosing cancers of the breast for that reason in those people, particularly under the age of 50. And this is the group that we're talking about so much, pretty regularly on this show, actually. Now, I mean, a mammogram is something that looks at tissue density. It's like I'm saying you're flying over the North Pole and you're looking for polar bears. They're white. The snow is white. You can't differentiate the two.
That's what it looks like in the mammogram.
Exactly. So we need a better test that doesn't work so much on tissue density. And there is a test that's available, but nobody's paying attention to it.
Well, some of the things, too, I just want to mention about that can bring about increasing your risk for breast cancer, like CT scans, especially if they use the radioactive dye over the chest, your abdomen, or your spine areas. Those will increase your risk of breast cancer. And many
That'd
times
be like
these
a
are
PET
done
scan.
For yeah. Or
okay. a PET
many
scan.
Times these tests are done for what? For your heart?
Oh, for other tests. Yes, yeah. Exactly. Yeah. People who are doing coronary arteriograms are the most serious ones. That's a huge dose of radiation that's being given.
And the other thing is, if somebody's had cancer and then they keep going in for regular checkups,
they're doing
and they're
PET
doing
CT scans.
CT scans.
Exactly.
To check if they've metastasized.
Right.
And what they're doing at the same time is increasing their risk for it.
That's a good
So
point.
I don't know what the answer is to that, but another thing that increases the risk as far as radiation goes are chest x-rays, which are overdone because many times it's recommended with an annual physical. Or if you work in the schools as a parent or as a helper or whatever, they're like, they want you to get chest x-rays. They're always encouraging chest x-rays, especially if you've had a positive TB test.
Well, you're right. Okay, well, there's a lot there. And close of our show, so I want to remind you that we're back to talk about what's new in the news and health, and take your health questions every Monday morning on PRN.FM and drsaputo.com from 10 to 11 a.m. Eastern Time and 7 to 8 a.m. Pacific Time. Prescriptions for Health will also be available 24/7 on drsaputo.com and prn.fm.
And if you enjoyed today's show and you'd like to have more information on the topics we discussed, go to Dr. Saputo Radio on drsaputo.com and check out our fast track videos. And remember, lifestyle is the most powerful healer in the universe. So if you want to be well, pay attention to the style in which you live your life.
Have a good week. We'll see you next time.